next case for argument this morning is Gillespie against the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Where is Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Counsel. Appellants, and I am one of the appellants in this case.
That is a question you will need to argue.
Yes, I know, Your Honor. See this first as a case involving only one major issue. The Congress of the United States, as part of the Restructuring Act in 1998, changed the law of the Internal Revenue Code to add two sections, 26 U.S.C. Section 6320 and 26 U.S.C. 6330. The legislative history and the case law to date, including Robinette versus Commissioner in the Eighth Circuit in 2006, make it clear that the change in the law was to give the taxpayer a chance to not have intrusive behavior in the collection process or errors in the assessment process extinguish the taxpayer's rights. In this particular case, the Gillespies filed a request for a collection due process hearing in approximately May of 2004. Some 2 months later, a hearing officer, Ms. Catherine Watkins, made a request that all matters necessary to consider collection alternatives and to consider a hearing be submitted to her in 30 days. This included the filing of what were then delinquent tax returns and included proposal of both collection alternatives and any other issues. Under these circumstances, the taxpayers who questioned whether or not the original assessment was correct and whether or not they had even been given notice of the original assessment, through a staff member, wrote a letter, who was the staff member on the power of attorney, wrote a letter to Ms. Watkins and requested information on approximately the 21st of September. On the 24th of September, Ms. Watkins claims that she called the undersigned, my office, and some unknown party said that that letter from the staff member was to act as a collection due process hearing. There was no collection due process hearing. She never responded again, Ms. Watkins, until sending out an adverse letter of determination. The adverse letter of determination showed up in January of 2005. And the result,
Counsel, as you know, the total allowed for argument is 10 minutes aside.
Yes, Your Honor.
You will need to get to your arguments if you
ever
hope to do so.
Yes, Your Honor, and this is the argument. There is no abuse by counsel in filing a petition and going forward in the tax court where there has been no collection due process hearing. For counsel to file such a petition is mandatory under the model rules of ethics, and in this case, of course, resulted in the correct result administratively.
What ethical rule requires the filing of frivolous legal proceedings?
There were no frivolous legal proceedings here, Your Honor.
Proceedings in this case were found by the tax court to be frivolous, and that seems almost undeniable.
That's clear error, Your Honor, on the part of the tax court. And it's clear error because...
Would you tell me what rule of ethics you are relying on? You invoked some rule of ethics, and I ask what rule you had in mind.
Your Honor, if I may, it's in my opening brief, but it is. But I think it's also mentioned in the reply brief. And if I may have just one moment. It's the ABA Model Rules of Professional Conduct 1.3, Your Honor, and it's the ABA Model Rules of Conduct 3.1. It is set out on pages 16 and 17 and 23 of my opening brief,
Your Honor. It shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness. The problem here is not delay. The problem here is substantive. And by the way, when I saw the citations to the ABA Model Rules in your brief, ABA model rules have no force in any jurisdiction. They're pertinent only to the extent they're adopted by the relevant governing body. Now, what are the ethical rules that apply to litigation in the tax court? Which rules has the tax court adopted?
The model rules from Washington, D.C., which has adopted basically the model rules of the ABA.
Adopted basically. Is there any citation here to the actual rules that were in force in the tax court?
Your Honor, there isn't. The tax court doesn't have its own set of ethical rules. They're the model rules of Washington, D.C., Your Honor. But the issue here is the litigation wasn't frivolous because there was no hearing. Congress never intended for taxpayers to be denied a hearing in the absence of mandatory language which allowed them a hearing.
I thought they just didn't show up.
Not true, Your Honor. Excuse me. You will see from both the government's brief and from our brief that the settlement officer claims that she made a call to my office and we said that the hearing, that the inquiry we made about discovery and relevant material was supposed to act as a hearing.
So you waived the hearing?
No, we didn't waive the hearing, Your Honor. No IRS agent in the world, that is an incredible statement, would ever allow an unidentified person, not recorded, with no documentation and no reference, to waive a statutory hearing. What I'm saying is, it is not credible that the IRS appeals officer ever made that call. No one has a record of that call or identifies a person, and the conduct is absolutely outside the bounds of any conduct engaged in by either the IRS or people who are qualified to practice before the Internal Revenue Service or the tax court. Moving on, if I may quickly, there is the jurisdictional issue, Your Honors, and it is true that the jurisdiction does not adequately appear in the notice of appeal. We would submit that under the case law and under the case law of the Supreme Court, the lengthy docketing statement filed within 1 week, which explains point by point.
Filed within 1 week of what?
The notice of appeal, Your Honor.
That's not when our docket shows it was received. The question, I should think, is whether the docketing statement was filed within the time for the filing of a notice of appeal. Was it?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it was filed within the time for the filing of the notice of appeal, but I believe it should be considered by the court anyway.
How can a notice of appeal be expanded by something filed after the jurisdictional time limit?
Because I believe that the Supreme Court case of Baker versus Montgomery, citing Smith versus Barry, very clearly sets out.
Smith was a case in which the appellate brief, the critical document, was filed within the time limit for taking a notice of appeal, and that was absolutely central to the Supreme Court's rationale. I'm interested in the question whether there is some decision which holds that a document filed after the time for a notice of appeal can expand the list of appellants.
Your Honor, I believe it's not clear from the record, but I believe that the filing on October 30th was within the time of the notice of appeal. The decision in the tax court case was not final until approximately August, the end of August, 2007. And the computation from that time till the time the notice of appeal was filed, followed by the docketing statement within 1 week, I believe are both within the court rules as far as the filing of appeals.
Time's up.
And, Your Honor, if I may, I have just one more statement I'd like to make in my opening.
Your time has expired, counsel. Ms. Evans.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Andrea Tebbets, appearing for the Commissioner. I'd like to address first this question of when the appeal period expired. The tax court entered two decisions. The first was on July 25th, which was the order imposing sanctions against Mr. Jones. The second order against the Gillespies and their trust was entered on July 27, 2007. Therefore, the appeal period ran, measured from the later of those two decisions, the appeal period expired on October 25, 2007. Mr. Jones's notice of appeal was filed on October 19th. His docketing statement, as I understand it, was filed on October 30th. That was outside.
Our docket shows it was filed on November 1.
Okay.
He mailed it on the 30th,
fine.
But it was docketed here on the 1st. It was filed on the 1st.
It was dated and mailed, I believe, October 30th. But in any case, this was after the appeal period had run. As to Mr. Jones's suggestion that all circumstances and documentation, including the docketing statement and the briefs, should be taken into account in determining his intent to appeal. The rules, the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 3C, the comment to that rule, and all of the cases that we have found indicate that the intent of an attorney to appeal an award of sanctions against him must be objectively clear from the notice of appeal, and indeed under the Second Circuit's EG case, from the face of the notice. It's our view that that this case is controlled by this court's decision in Reed, in which the notice of appeal did not so much as hint at the attorney's intent to appeal the order against him. Here, the notice of appeal states that the Gillespies hereby appeal. Mr. Jones signed the notice of appeal solely as attorney for the Gillespies. He was not a party to the suit and to the tax court case, and hence he was not included in the et al. In the caption of the tax court case. There were two separate orders. Retail Flooring, the Ninth Circuit case, is distinguishable because there the notice of appeal referred only to one order that was the sanctions order against the attorney. Here there were two separate orders. The notice of appeal, in fact, doesn't refer to either order. It refers to the opinion of the tax court, but that too covered the sanctions both against the Gillespies and against Mr. Jones. So there really is no way to, there is no objective clarity in this case as to whether Mr. Jones intended to appeal the sanctions order against him. And for that reason, we submit, as we've explained in our brief, that the court lacks jurisdiction over Mr. Jones's appeal of the award against him. regardless, and certainly as to the Gillespies, we submit that the tax court awards of sanctions and costs were entirely warranted. Mr. Jones today has discussed at length the circumstances of the taxpayers' failure to participate in the actual scheduled hearing. That is not relevant for the purposes of this appeal. And in fact, none of the challenges that specific challenges that Mr. Jones has raised to the notices of determination are relevant. His attempts to defend those challenges as non-frivolous are, in a sense, irrelevant because the taxpayers stipulated below that the notices of determination should be sustained. In essence, they conceded that the notices of determination were properly issued, that they were proper in substance, that there was no abuse of discretion by Ms. Watkins, the settlement officer, in issuing those notices of determination, and hence there can be no abuse of discretion by the court, by the tax court, in having upheld those notices. Mr. Jones continues to say, to try to justify the outcome here by saying that the taxpayers settled their liabilities and therefore the correct result was reached in this case. The liabilities, the taxpayers' liabilities, were not an issue in this case. They were precluded by statute, section 6330C2B of the Internal Revenue Code, from being considered at all in the CDP proceeding and hence from being considered by the tax court. That provision states that a taxpayer may raise in a collection due process, and I'm using the acronym CDP proceeding, may raise the underlying liability only if he or she, in this case they, did not receive a statutory notice of deficiency or otherwise have an opportunity to contest the liability. Here it is undisputed that a notice of deficiency, notices of deficiency for all the years in issue were issued, were mailed. There's simply no dispute about that. Therefore, the taxpayers could not contest their liabilities. That is all they have sought to do in this case from start to finish. They requested a CDP hearing on the ground that they did not owe the liabilities that were sought to be collected. They raised the same point throughout the proceedings. That is frivolous by definition. To center a case on a precluded issue is frivolous by definition, and we submit that the costs and sanctions were properly entered to the extent that there is jurisdiction against Mr. Jones. If there is not, then the cost order, sanctions order against him must be upheld. If there are no questions, I will rely on our brief. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.